You're listening to Jungle Janna Radio with Jungle Janna and Angel Garcia, only on LA Talk Radio.
Yay! I love the song.
Okay. So,
yeah, everyone's muted. Listen. Oh boy.
Yep. You might want to can everybody hear over the car driving?
I can hear.
I lost audio.
Okay. So, first
I'm muted,
let's introduce,
so I'll be back.
Okay, Janina Sean.
Yes.
I want to tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes. So my name is Janina. I have founded a rescue organization on the Osa Peninsula about 13 years ago, Osa Peninsula, Costa Rica, Southern Pacific. And actually just now, recently, as of a month or so ago, I created a 501c3 in California, US. So now we are an official charity, tax deductible, and I can apply for more funding over here in the U.S., which is really exciting.
So I know that you send plane loads of dogs out, rescue animals.
Well, sort of. I used to
I've
send
been
out
muted
a bunch
again.
Of wow. dogs. No, you're alive.
We heard that.
We heard what you're saying.
So sent dogs up to Canada, US,
I can't hear anyone.
Europe, Germany, everywhere, right? But mainly we give dogs up for adoption in Costa Rica, right? And
right.
on the actual Osa Peninsula. When, you know, sometimes when we get the opportunity, there's people that want to adopt from abroad. So then they get to take the dog home, or we can send the dog somewhere. I'm now working on new connections, hopefully in LA area, that I'm hoping I can make some connections in this area with rescues that might want to receive a puppy from us every now and then. It wouldn't be a load of puppies. It would be maybe, you know, 5-6 dogs a year max. But those dogs that are just sometimes deemed unadoptable in Costa Rica, like because they have 3 legs or they have some kind of disability, Costa Ricans are very much about dogs that are intact, that are whole, that are healthy. And if a dog has only 3 legs, they don't serve as well as a alarm dog or, you know.
Well, you know, I fostered a dog. And then I couldn't let it go, so I'm not a good foster. I had to keep it.
Right. And, that happens to us all the time.
And so I have 4 of those now.
Yes.
I fall in love with everything.
Yeah. I'm the same way. So is Josh, too.
I know Josh takes...
Tough.
So Josh takes... when you're out of Costa Rica, he takes care of your dogs, doesn't he? Josh?
He used to back in the day. Now I have someone else that watches them at my house.
A little more reliable, you mean?
No, just, you know, I need Josh at my house. I also run Airbnbs, so I have 2 vacation rentals, and Josh is based at my vacation rentals and helping me co-host over there. And I moved in with my boyfriend a few years ago, and we have another home which also needs caretaking when we are gone, and so the dogs stay there now. But Josh also has dogs at the Airbnb, which
who keeps putting me on mute
adopted.
Here?
Okay, so we're gonna go back and forth between the two of you, because Janina, you're gonna be. I'm glad you're on the show today. I had you got scheduled.
Oh, boy.
I'd ask Randall. He's coming again next week,
you guys.
Randall,
it all froze.
No, I can hear you.
It's all frozen.
It's all frozen. I can hear you and see you. Perfect, yeah. Randall. So just talk. I can see it.
Oh, everybody's dropped off.
Okay. So we'll just go back to, I want to hear about when you made the solar panels.
Yeah.
The schools.
Yeah. I did that like a while back. So we did like a project where, you know, so I have a, not just a dog rescue organization, but also a volunteer organization. So both I founded sort of at the same time, but both go hand in hand, right? Because the dogs needed volunteers to help them. And I realized, you know, there's so many other projects in Costa Rica and so many areas that need help, and not just the dogs, but also the turtles, the wildlife, you know, people, right? And so everything stemmed from there. And the solar project was born together with a good friend of mine that was also in the solar world, like as a solar installer. And we, you know, combined our forces and started this workshop. So it started as a workshop teaching kids about solar. So kids meaning, you know, they were already adults, but young adults coming from the US, from Canada, from Europe. And they came down to Costa Rica to learn about solar energy. As we know, the Osa Peninsula still has a lot of solar.
So y'all actually, they actually transitioned into creating solar panels for all the schools that did not have electricity on OSA.
And
we did that. Yeah.
There was a workshop, and I remember when this was happening, I had a friend, an older friend living up in the mountains, and I volunteered him to go to the classes, and he learned how to make his own panels.
Right.
And he did, and he set them up. And then the ISE, the electric company of Costa Rica, was interested in his system and set it up. So they connected to him, and it continued on to all his neighbors. So there's that one person having it set up in the mountains ended up connecting like five families up there.
Okay. So we're going to switch to Randall, because Randall, can we make the announcement today?
Yeah,
about
sure.
What I'm doing in October.
Okay. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Why don't you give everybody, but first, you give everybody, you tell everybody about what you do and what you have been doing on Isla de Coco for how many years and the studies?
Well, I started my work in Coco's Island in 2005, 20 years ago. I've already developed a slightly over 30-year career in marine conservation in Costa Rica.
Right.
So starting with turtles.
Give us a quick overview. I mean, your resume, your
okay.
Curriculum vitae is insane.
What? Do we have an hour?
He's coming back next week.
Just kidding.
No, I'll just be a really quickie here. People always ask me, you know, about my accent, my California accent. And I'm a son of Costa Rican immigrants that went to live in Los Angeles in the 1950s. I was born when they were living there. And then after they lived there for 15 years in 1971, the family moved back to Costa Rica. I was 10 years old, and I've been living here in Costa Rica ever since. So I've always liked to say I'm not only bilingual, I'm also bicultural. I go from the gringo culture to the Tico culture back and forth, and I'm comfortable at all sites. So, you know, that's my personal background. And then ever since I lived in California, when I was 8 or 9 years old, I always tell the story how I would watch the Jacques Cousteau movies. You know, Jacques Cousteau inspired a whole generation of us. And even back then I would say, I want to be an oceanographer, but I really meant I want to be a biologist, a marine biologist. But I pursued my dreams. And when I studied in the university, I decided to go for sea turtle conservation. And then my early career was working with sea turtles, and then it eventually shifted into sharks. But what has really made my organization and the work I do different than others, not exactly different, but what puts me apart from others is not only a scientist. I try to be the best scientist I can, try to publish my papers. But as you know, it's very competitive in the academic world. But I'm more well known for my policy impact. And it's taking that science and turning it into policy, shoving it in politicians' faces, educating the public about it. And when everything else fails, which unfortunately many times it does, then we go to court. But before we go to court, we have to have the public opinion on our side. We have to have the science. And if the courts are fair, if you got the science on your side, and if you got the laws on your side, you're going to win.
So
excellent.
Tell us. Okay. I want to know. There's so much I want to know. I want you to tell. I want to know about the swimway. I want to know about Cocos Island and what we're going to be doing there in October. And then I want to know about the new shark that's been discovered and named after Costa Rica. There's so much I want to know.
Okay. Well, my work with sharks is focused mainly on hammerheads, although now it is spread out to other species. But when we started, you know, the classic conservation model, you know, you're protecting Cocos Island, you're protecting Galapagos, you're protecting Malpelo because you see the schools of hammerhead sharks there. And that's where the government's put all their effort. But I've been dedicating my career since I started working in Cocos Island on studying the migratory movements of these animals. And now we know that these protected areas are interconnected by roads, or what we call migravias or swimways. The animals aren't just randomly swimming around. They have like these highways or routes that they're following. And the important thing about this is we know that the animals are schooling in Cocos. We know they're schooling in Galapagos. And now we know that they're moving in between these sites. And what we've learned about this is no matter how much we protect Cocos and no matter how much we protect Galapagos strictly from fishing, if we're not protecting them in between, right, they're going to get fished out regardless. And our conservation efforts are going to be useless. And that's probably why some of these populations continue to decline and their situation is more and more dire. We need more complete conservation strategies and management. And for instance, these swimways must be thoroughly protected. And just to wrap this up, imagine you have your kids at home and you're sending your kids to school. Your kids are safe in school. They're safe in home. You're happy. But what if they have to walk down a street with no sidewalks and the cars are speeding by? Or what if it's a bad neighborhood, you know, drugs and thieves? And you're not going to be happy if your kids aren't safe on the way to school. So we need to make the whole pathway safe. Otherwise, no matter how much we protect them on the ends, we're not going to get the job done. That's what's happening with the hammerhead sharks. And for our expedition now, what we're doing is we're going to retrieve our traveling acoustic technology, and we're also going to tag some animals to study these movements and convince the authorities to make the right policy changes.
And I get to go on one of them.
Oh, it's going to be all fantastic.
Right. I can't wait. So that's October. Are there any spaces for any people, like, you know, I am a diver, and I guess you have to be a diver to go, or people can go if they...
Okay. Well, you can go if you're not a diver, but there's really not much to do because, you know, right, we stay on the liverboard. We only go to the mainland once, you know, to check it out and do some trails. But, you know, when people are in Cocos Island, they usually want to dive. You know, you don't want to miss anything.
Right, well, I like diving.
Yeah.
So, I would love to go.
Okay.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah. Let's go.
He's a diver.
It's and, October 3rd actually, to the 7th, right?
No, 3rd to 13th.
Third it's to 13th. Oh, I'm so excited now.
It's 10 days. It's a day and a half to get there. And it's 7 days at the site with 3 dives a day. And we're going to be, and this trip in particular, we're going to be focusing on the manta rays. So we're going to be tagging them underwater with pole spears and attaching satellite tags to them. And this is the real cool thing we just found out. There's a chain of mountains, a volcanic mountain range that goes from Cocos to Galapagos. That's the swimway. And the animals are moving along that ridge because it's magnetic. And the sharks are following those magnetic fields. But now it turns out, well, we knew this already, but what we're seeing is that this chain of mountains continues from Cocos Island all the way to the Osa Peninsula.
So that's like the continuation of the swimway. Chill bumps are going to make me cry.
Right. And now we're calling that the Cocos Osa Swimway because a sea turtle that we tagged some years ago did the trip from Cocos to the Osa Peninsula in 12 days. That's 500 kilometers in 12 days. Wow. But last July, I tagged a manta ray on Cocos Island, and it made that same move in 5 days. So that's 500 kilometers in 5 days. That's 100 kilometers a day. And right on that ridge.
From Cocos?
From Cocos to the Osa.
Oh, my gosh.
So it swam right on that ridge, and that is giving us the scientific evidence to try to consolidate more information and try to get that corridor protected as well. So, so we need to identify these sites and make sure they get protected.
So, so this is from the 3rd to the 13th. I don't know if you heard this, Angel, but I'm going to be on that boat, and they're going to have scientists on there, and they're going to be working on this project. We have an idea, and he's going to check the speed on the Starlink on the live board, and we hope to do a little radio series live from Cocos Island. Yeah.
We want live updates. Cool.
Sam said yes, so I'm down.
Do we already begin?
Huh? Yeah.
What time does this show start?
You know exactly what time it starts.
Time late.
Oh, Janina, you want to come to Cocos?
I didn't get to hear everything. And Jamina, I did get to hear about the adoptions for the dogs and stuff. That was pretty cool. And well, Josh, I know. Hi. Listen, Joe, I thought you were a whale watcher, not a dog watcher. So I can understand why she went to go look for somebody else. So, I totally get it.
I've been working with Janina on this, for, I don't know, 10 years or so. And, you know, being a host for dogs, and I get it how it's hard when you bring them in and you get them healthy again, and then they're all loving you, and then you have to adopt them away. Sometimes it's tough. That's why I tend to gather some doggies as well. Again with Randall, with there's a place here in the OSA that has all this nice seagrass that the turtles love to eat.
Yeah, from Galapagos they come and feed.
And that's what they come to eat. So I think it's important that we make sure we protect that area, because if that grass goes away, they might not want to come here anymore. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, that's one of the most threatened habitats now.
Yeah.
In the Pacific, there used to be many of those seagrass meadows in different parts of Costa Rica. Lots of them got wiped out in the 50s and 60s by the shrimp trawlers, and they're not really coming back. And
now we have the
you guys there.
Yes.
Now we have the palmatica with all the West African palm tree plantations. And they have a lot of fertilizers that are being pushed out of the rivers, and they're kind of making that grass bloom in a weird way. So I don't know.
And what's your take on that, Randall?
Well, it's not one of the areas I work in. There are NGOs working down there. But see, like, I tend to be very confrontational when it comes to these kind of things. And, I usually go directly to court and whatever. And I've noticed, lots of NGOs that I've worked with, they don't like that. They say, I'll support you or whatever, but they don't want to, they don't like to, no poning el pecho, like they don't go out there and take the bullets. But that's what it takes here in Costa Rica. And like I said, I made a difference in my career doing that. Like when I started my career in 1997, by 1999, we saw the green turtle slaughterhouse on the Atlantic coast of Costa Rica, Limon. And they were allowed to kill 1,800 turtles during 3 months from July to September. And they had a permit from Incopesca. And I would go there, and I'm starting my career as an activist, and I say, why are you guys killing these green turtles? They're endangered. They're protected by the IUCN and by CITES, And they would say, oh, but green turtles aren't commercial species, aren't wildlife. Green turtles are commercial species. People eat them all the time. And it's like, yeah, but they're endangered. So I took them to court, and we shut down the green turtle fishery.
We did.
We also shut down the shrimp trawl fishery. And we've had a lot of impact. Nice. Like we're trying to shut down the shark fishery right now. But I try to be reasonable. I try to be a sustainable biologist, and we provide the science, and we look at the laws and whatever. And and we try to make these improvements. But when the law isn't abided by, and when science is ignored, then it's like, well, if we're not going to do policy based on science and on the laws that exist, then I'm losing my time doing science.
So I got a question now. Since you've told us about the swimway and it's the Osa Peninsula to Galapagos, and then it's over to it's
the Osa,
and then it's the Osa, and then it's over to El Palo. What has happening on this expedition I'm going to be a part of?
Okay. Well, to follow the movements of these animals, we have different technologies, but the main technologies we use, is acoustic tracking. So we go underwater with the pole spear, or sometimes we fish the sharks. And when they swim by, we poke them with the pole spear. And it's a device that looks kind of like a lighter. It's like a cylindrical device like this. And it emits a sound at 69 kilohertz, which is inaudible to us. But we put these things on the sharks, and then it pings, as we say, every minute. So then in Cocos Island, there's different places that we call cleaning stations, which is where the hammerheads come to get cleaned. So at the cleaning stations, we deploy these receivers. The receiver is basically a listening station. So what it does is it's listening to the tags to the animals that we deployed the tags on. So whenever the animal swims within 500 meters of one of our receivers, which are stationary, we get a hit. So we have 8 of those receivers all around Cocos Island, and we have receivers, 8 receivers on the mainland of Costa Rica. And then that way we can detect the animals as they're moving around. And the technology has limitations because we don't really see a track, but we do know he was here this day, he was here over this day. This day he was absent from this site. And that way we can put it together and we can figure out how they're moving around. But for this, we also have to know kind of like where the animals aggregate. And, you know, and that's a good thing about the cleaning stations.
And explain to them, I know what a cleaning station is, but for those who don't dive may not know.
Okay. The cleaning stations are the coolest thing.
They're totally cool.
Yeah. They're designated areas, you know, that they, I don't know how long, but it seems like forever. I've been going to Cocos for 20 years and the cleaning stations haven't changed. And a cleaning station is basically a rock, which has nothing special than other rocks, but little fish live in the rocks, and they're usually the butterfly fish, sometimes angel fish, and the they're barber. Sitting on the rocks. And when the sharks are coming in, the hammerhead sharks, the females are coming in after mating. So they have all these mating scars and loose flesh. So what they do is, and this is the cool thing, that the hammerheads are very skittish. They're afraid of the bubbles and everything. But when they come to the cleaning station, they move in and they go into a weird trance. They spread out their fins and they turn sideways, and all the little fish come and start pecking on them and cleaning their skin. And when they're in this stage, they become careless. And that's when we can sneak in and poke them with the tag.
See, isn't that cool?
Wow.
Oh, it's super cool. And it's really fun too, because sometimes you're looking at the fish waiting for the shark, and you know the shark is coming because you see all the fish go in one direction. And you go, oh, there comes a shark. And then sure enough, you see the shark coming by. And then, you know, sharks have cleaning stations. What do you call them? Manta rays have different cleaning stations at different sites. So it seems like there's designated cleaning stations for different species.
That's pretty interesting, the tracking device, that round cylindrical
thing. I know.
Yeah, it is, because my wife gave me one of those, the wear, and she told me it was that. And I did not know that that's what it was.
Actually, here's one. I just found one on my desk.
Exactly what it was. She put that around me and said, hey, they're wearing these things. Yeah.
So, oh, my gosh. Oh, my.
No, I have a question, though, for Janina, because I missed a lot of what you said earlier, but I did catch about the amount of dogs that you get adopted, you know, through a year or something like that. But is that something you've always done, or is this something you went to Costa Rica and saw there was a need and started to do that, or is this something you've already done prior?
I've always had an interest in dogs, and I worked at a dog boarding, like, training facility for a while before I came to Costa Rica. I lived in Canada and I worked there in that dog training facility, and it was like overnight daycare training. And I my boss at the time, he followed Cesar Millan's method. So one of my jobs was to read all of Cesar's books. That was my study task to work there, right? He was like, I want everyone that works here has to read these books and has to follow these guidelines. And I loved it. I read all his books. I started practicing, you know, the dog training. But it's fascinating to me. Like, dogs, I always loved dogs. And when I was a little kid, we adopted a dog from the shelter. And I think that's where it all began. I was maybe eight years old. And we went to the shelter. My mom took me, and there was a little litter with little puppies. And I got to pick my dog. And since then, I was always, Mom, why is there shelters? Why is there dogs? And I asked all these questions. And we would go back to the shelter, and I would help there, even when I already had my little doggy, because I just felt so bad for these dogs there. I was like, why? You know, I just couldn't understand that there was even shelters, right? As a kid, you're like, this is all new. And you know, as I grew up and older, I guess it just came back to me when I came to Costa Rica. I saw all these abandoned animals on the beach, you know, in town, like Puerto Jimenez, where we live. It was just packs of dogs everywhere. And, you know, dogs that had mange and that were in heat. And then, you know, the chaos and the madness with the dogs following a dog in heat. And I would rescue that female because I would feel so bad for her, you know, being surrounded by like 10 males trying to, you know, do their thing. And the poor little doggy. And I just couldn't watch it. I couldn't watch it. I don't know how anyone could watch that. I was literally asking people, why is there no one doing anything? And then I started doing something. You know, I just started very small. Like my first fundraiser was at Martina's bar, which is like a jungle bar, a small community bar. And I raffled out a surfboard and I got some money, you know. Then I did another thing. Then I got some tourists involved and that started donating to me. And I just kept growing and growing from there. And here we are. The rest is history.
And it's been, if I can interject, it's over the years, you can see the difference. I mean,
I can see a difference.
There was wild packs of dogs running through the streets, and the local police would actually put poisoned meat out, and then you'd find all these dead dogs out, right? So after what Janina's done, you know, she brings in donations, and then we work with the veterinarian, and we've traveled with the vet to the mountains and to these farms, and then the vet is working on the dogs there. So these five dogs aren't going to multiply.
They also have a huge impact. They also have a huge impact on small animal life when they're out there with nobody to take care of them.
Yeah, right.
You know,
on turtles as well, wildlife. Yeah. 100%. It's a big issue still in Karate, areas like Karate, where Karate is like at the border of Corcovado National Park. And it's just, it continues to be an issue, but we have now to the point of where it's in control. And
it is
out of control anymore. Yeah. It used to be out of control. Like dogs would go dig up nests and all the time. Yeah. Totally. The time. Yeah. So, and just quickly say to Randall as well, my background is also biology. I studied biology, Bachelor of Science, and then a Master's in Environmental Studies. And that's how I actually ended up in Costa Rica, because I studied in my master's, I did research squirrel monkeys and pet trade. So hunting for pet trade and monkeys. It was through my professor at the time from my Canadian university that had a relationship with Costa Rica. And now, I don't know if you guys, maybe Randall, you know, since I've graduated, they have actually built a research center in Chirripó. So in the foothills of Chirripó Mountain, it's called Las Nubes. It's from York University. Mm-hmm. And now it's actually a really big thing. When I did my research, that didn't exist yet. I was one of the first people that did that. So I went there, did my research. I lived at a host family. There was no station. There was no research center yet. And I just did it on my own. I just was so interested in that. And and then I fell in love with Costa Rica and ended up staying.
Yeah, the monkey trade, was that a big thing? Because I know like the macaw trade used to be huge in Costa Rica. It's declined dramatically too. But what about monkeys? Was monkeys ever a big issue?
Yeah, it was. And it, when I was researching it, which was 2010, 2011, there was still an ongoing black market of monkey trade. And we had proof because I did. So this was in Paris-Celedon area, right? Like in that sort of area where monkeys don't, the squirrel monkeys don't live. In the wild. So they only live in coastal areas and specifically on the Osa, along the Costa Ballena coast. and they don't exist in Parseldon. That's too far up. It's too high in the mountains. But there were troops of monkeys there, and that's how this whole thing started. Why were the monkeys in the mountains? And so we found out these troops of monkeys were actually escaped pets that had reproduced and formed little, their own little troops in areas where they normally don't exist. And we found out too, we went to households, did interviews with people that were hunters and went to the Osa, hunted these squirrel monkey babies, captured them, brought them up to Parseldon and kept them there as pets. It was super interesting. And, you know, we had to promise them, hey, we're not reporting this to MINAED, which is the Ministry of Environment in Costa Rica, right? We're not, they were scared because they didn't want to let me interview them at first. They were like, what if we are going to get caught, right? This was illegal also at that time, but it wasn't really reinforced, you know, and people would get away with stuff, right? And I definitely found that there was still an active monkey trade going on. Yeah, and especially
some of those make it all the way to the United States.
Yeah,
I mean, well, you're the monkey expert. I have a question. Now that we're talking about that, I remember back when I was in college. So this is outdated information, but I remember reading about the squirrel monkey in one of my courses, and they said that because of their odd distribution, they were in the Osa Peninsula, they were in Manuel Antonio, like in only a few pockets, but very patchy, that they thought that they were probably brought only a few hundred years ago from South America as pets on boats or something.
They may not be really endemic.
I didn't know.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
I didn't know
and then
about that.
Hearing this story that, you know, that they're showing up in Parseldon, maybe they're very adaptable. I don't know. I just, like I said, that's why I'd rather consult, because this is a story I heard decades ago.
Yeah.
Yes,
and I've,
could be.
I'm glad you brought that up. It's so interesting.
The myth that I've heard and stories I've heard just passed down around here is the squirrel monkeys came just like riding on people's shoulders coming up from South America, and they were used kind of as trade with, as people made their way up, they were like had a value and they'd trade squirrel monkeys. So
give you this monkey for some coffee.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. They just kind of rode on people's shoulders as they're walking up, and then they finally made it here. So can I get a fact check on that over there?
Yeah.
But again, that's just one of the, you know,
when
the myths.
They were trading up the squirrel monkeys. I thought they traded up to what, an ape? You know, like,
I'll give you three squirrel monkeys for a capuchin.
I think knowing all this stuff, and yeah, you know, when Jana asked me, "Hey, Angel, I want you to be a co-host with me on this radio show," and one of the things that she said is, "What's good is that you don't know a lot of this stuff, and I don't." And so I'm learning so much from everybody.
Yeah, but he's a general manager of a radio station in Texas. So yeah, he knows how to ask questions. He's a great interviewer.
Nice. But it's not that though. It's also my curiosity that actually leads to the questions that I ask, because I find it so interesting. And like I told Jana, I said, you know, and I think I said it to Josh, you know, the amazing thing is, and Janina, I didn't hear your story on this, but you know, the amazing thing is I'm scared to go to Costa Rica because it seems like nobody leaves. that's the truth. And so that's kind of where I'm at on that. But you know, I enjoy all the information from Josh and from Randall and Janina, your story as well, because I've learned so much. I really
hear stuff today I didn't know about.
I say something stupid every now and then, but you know, it's my defense mechanism against the stuff I don't know. You know,
I don't even know how to ask.
All I know is I know nothing. Yeah, so start from there.
I have a question to Randall though. So Randall, I heard, I mean, this might be a little controversial, but I heard that recently there was a shark attack on Cocos Island with a diver. Is that true? Have you heard about that?
Well,
heard about that?
There have been several attacks over the years. One was fatal, which might be the one you're talking about. That was in December of 2017. Now you have to consider, though, Cocos Island is a hotspot for sharks. You dive there and you're surrounded by them. And these are apex predators. You know, they do bite, you know, but it's a matter of respect, you know, respecting their boundaries. And, you know, just showing also authority, not being afraid of them. It's kind of like, if you're walking down the street and a dog runs out of a house, you know, barking at you. If you run away, you'll trigger that predator instinct and they'll probably bite you in the ass. But if you just hold your ground, you hold your ground, the dog, you know, he'll start barking around you, whatever. And with sharks, it's pretty much the same. The rule is just never freak out. If it comes in too close, stand up, you know, instead of lying down, stand up. That way you look bigger. And they're usually just curious, you know, like I've never had an incident before. And then if you consider all the people that go to Coco's Island, you know, and how many dives they do there per year and the interactions that they've had with sharks, it's really insignificant. And that accident that did happen in 2017 was very, very unfortunate, but it was also, you know, it was just so unpredictable, you know, the only explanation is
I dive with bull sharks every year.
No, like I dive with bull sharks, and I dive with all sorts of sharks. I go diving with the pole spear, and I tag them underwater, and they just swim away.
I know,
you know, and they don't, you know, we used to think they would turn around and snap at us and whatever. No, you just poke them and they swim away, you know. So, you know, it's a matter of respect too. And
I think what we're trying to explain is you got to respect the food source of the shark, because if they lose their food source, there's a more chance they're going to bite you in the ass. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's what we're trying to work on. And I'm on when I take my boat tours out and I'm taking all these people out and exploring the Gulf here, you know, every time people ask, are there sharks here? You know, and so I dip my finger in the water and I go, yeah, there is, you know, it's salt water, you know, so, but I don't see too many. I mean, I see some white tip reef sharks, and I've had some amazing whale shark experiences. That's for sure. Just unbelievable.
So I want to ask Randall a question.
What about thresher sharks? Do you see them?
No.
Because one of the first things I discovered when I got to OSA, I didn't know anything. And I noticed around the Mogos, we were in a little boat, we were a little kayak for two, and we came up on it, baby hammerheads.
Oh, yeah.
And so the nursery for the hammerheads as well as the other shark species.
Well, yeah, the whole Golfo Dulce is.
Right.
And, you know, that's the thing. Yeah, and that's one of the conservation problem with hammerhead sharks. And is that when they're babies, they live in mangrove swamps or in enclosed areas, and they're subject to the small scale fishermen. But then they get a little bigger. They eat shrimp and, you know, little.
I've seen them with a pink belly, the little baby hammerheads. And I always thought it's because they eat so many shrimp, they have like a little pink.
Well, they eat all sorts of invertebrates. When they're small, they have a very wide variety. As they grow, they start specializing in their diet. And when they're adults, they eat nothing but squid.
Okay.
Oh, wow. All right.
Hey, well, listen, it was a pleasure meeting all. Josh, I can't wait to go on a boat with you. Janina, I'll help you.
Yeah.
Handle you on your own. I'm not getting in the water with no sharks. I'm just saying that. And stand up and make yourself bigger. If I do that to make myself bigger, I feel like I'm just letting them pick a limb. So, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to do that. I have an appointment I have to get to.
It's a real pleasure
seeing everybody.
But well, talk to Jana when she's back.
Yeah.
Oh.
Talk to Jana when she's back from Coco's.
He will be. I do radio with him here in Lampasas, some in my hometown. I'm in his house right now doing my show.
Well, we're looking forward to the live. See you later, Angel.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Okay.
Okay, bye. Glad to meet you.
Pleasure.
Nice to meet you.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Okay, so do you have any questions for Randall about the trip, Janina?
Yeah, I'm curious. Yeah, I would love to. I mean, I have to see if it works with our calendar. It should. Right now, I don't think I have anything at that time. And it would be me and my partner, Lance. Lance is actually a master diver. So he has done the whole program up to, you know, he's on the level of being able to teach divers, but he's not a diver. It's not his profession.
Okay, well, are you there?
Yeah. Earlier,
I think Janina's frozen. I need Janina's email.
I'll send it to you on your WhatsApp.
Send it to me, and I'll send you the information, because right now we're kind of like in a tight spot. So I can give you a really nice discount, especially if you come with your partner. I can give you a significant discount.
That will be amazing. Yes.
Nice. That would be amazing if you join us.
I'm so excited for you guys.
This is fantastic.
I have another question. Is October not a month where the water is very turbid? Like in Costa Rica, normally it's like they say, you know, October is not a good dive month because it's rainy season. There's like this debris, but it, obviously Cocos is far offshore. Doesn't matter there. It's always great visibility there.
There's not always great visibility, but that has to do with the upwelling. So sometimes when you're there, it can be in the middle of the dry season and you get an upwelling of cold water and then the visibility. But even a bad day in visibility in Cocos is so much better than a good day on the mainland. Visibility is always great. You know, sometimes it's a little murkier or whatever, but it's always pretty good. The thing about October, too, is it's usually one of the best months because it has the worst weather. It's rainiest. And that's when the currents are stronger. And that's also what attracts more of the animals.
They're going next to shore.
Mm-hmm. The sharks like that. And you get lots of upwelling and the water gets colder and the sharks like that a lot.
That's why I'd be there to see the wildlife under the sea.
Yes. Oh, my God. Is this your first time, Jana, to go to
this
Cocos?
This is my first time to Cocos. I mean, I was in the Great Barrier Reef November last year.
Oh my God.
I've only seen it on Jurassic Park.
I haven't been to Cocos. Yeah. I've been to Caño. Been all over Costa Rica.
Been to Cocos. It's been on my bucket list.
I know. It's on my bucket list. I was telling my friend Bobby.
All right.
Used to be on the show.
Okay. Well, I'll send you the information. I hope you decide to make it again. And, there's going to be other researchers with me. And so in the evenings, we do talks. You know, we talk about the science, we talk about conservation, how you can help, people, it's perfect for people who like sharks and marine conservation.
So you can download this show, but how would people reach you? Say that about three times in a row.
Okay. Well, you can go to my website, which is, first of all, social media. My name is Randall Arauz. It's right down there. So just go to Instagram and punch my name in. And, Instagram is the easiest way. And right now I hardly Facebook because everything is connected to the Instagram. So everything gets out there. And, that's probably the easiest way. You can also go to my website, which is www.cremacr.org. That's the website. And that's where all our news is at and everything. But to contact me, the easiest way is just get me on my Instagram account.
Okay, perfect.
You have a YouTube channel too. I subscribed to you last night.
All right. We have to get better at that. I'm trying to hire
because
some
you only
help.
Have 8 subscribers now, and I'm number 8.
we got to get better at that. We're trying to get more.
You've got
into
a bunch of great
media.
Videos.
I'm
just a YouTube guy and you have tons of videos on there that really go through all the years. There's a big gap in there from 16 years ago. There's a lot 14 years ago and then a few from the last couple, like last year. Let me ask you this.
Do you have somebody that takes film underwater film when you're there?
No, I always carry a GoPro on my head. I film everything I do. But usually on my trips, there's professionals or photographers come on the trips. So I always have access to their footage,
That's great.
They let me use their professional stuff usually. And since it's for nonprofit, their people are usually cool with me using their stuff.
Yeah. Amazing. So how many minutes do we have left? I have to put on my glasses. We have
15 more minutes left.
Yeah. We're off at they take us out at 1:50, so we still have 6 minutes left.
Just something about rescue dogs.
Yeah,
used to have nothing but purebred dogs. Weimaraners were my thing, but then I have a daughter, and she decided to study veterinary medicine, and she turned into a veterinarian. And slowly, the purebred dogs have been dying out, and the mutts are moving in, and now we have nothing but mutts. Rescue mutts.
Yeah.
And it was pretty cool. Right. Oh, my dog was here just a minute ago. Oh, here she is.
Saguates.
Breaking up here.
Saguates.
I love them. Hey, they look
always.
Look at you.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
What's our name here?
So Maya.
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 Yeah. We rescued her in February.
Que belleza.
Hang on, I gotta show you mine now.
It's such a good feeling to save a dog.
She's right here. She's on.
All right. She's on. Ooh, dog competition.
Look at her little dog. Oh my God. This is a Chihuahua Deanna. Pitbull mix.
Deanna.
Aww. It's adorable.
And it's such a nice feeling. You know?
She's lovely. Yeah. I mean, at one point, obviously, I had nine dogs and four cats together with my ex-boyfriend. But now it's down to three dogs and a cat, which is a lot more manageable. But I understand with your daughter that will happen. If you're especially in Costa Rica, is she in Costa Rica? Or is she in
LA? She's in Costa Rica.
I have six dogs and a cat.
And the interesting thing with my daughter, is she started, working in clinics here in San Jose. But our headquarters, my NGO headquarters, is in Guanacaste in Coyote, a little rural town. And she fell in love with the place. And there's all these mutts there and dogs without attention. And there's also a very big community of U.S. expats and Europeans and whatever. So she moved there and she started her clinic there. And she has to do a lot of free or almost pro bono work for the locals. But she makes up with all the expats and the foreigners who pay her the full rates. And she's not making as much money, but she's super happy with what she's doing. And, she's about to buy a property and she's going to, she wants to establish herself there. And she's doing something I always wanted to do since I was young, which is living on the coast.
Right. Yeah.
I haven't been able to move out of San Jose, but she is.
Hey, so good. Randall.
I would love to connect with her. I mean, I always love
I'll send you emails, each other's email.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We'll do the exchange now. I'll hook you up.
Randall, if you ever make it down here, you can always go on my boat with me. You have a lifetime guarantee to be on my boat for free.
Free boat.
All right. So where are you based?
As long as I'm alive, you can go on my peninsula. Boat. Okay?
Gulf of Dulce, Puerto Menes.
You guys, man, I got it down. I mean, I've been on the Gulf of Dulce about 22 years. I used to do kayak tours around and camping, and then I've been doing boating about 15 years. On the Gulf and seeing Piedras Blancas National Park and going up the Rio Esquinas. And it's just amazing. And there's always something new to see here. It's just incredible.
I've got to tell this before we run out of time, because it's a cool story. I'm in Mogos on the radio on LA Talk. And I get a phone call on my regular phone. I'm on, LA Talk Radio, and I look there and it's my phone and I'm doing the radio, how we do it here. And so I'm on the phone and it rings and it's Josh and he's out front of Mogos and a baby whale is being born. So I had Sam.
All right.
They called him and he got to talk to us as that baby whale was being born live on LA Talk Radio.
Oh my God.
The mom's slapping the tail.
Yeah.
And the baby comes out. And then the mom's bringing the baby up like this to breathe. She's bringing the baby up for the first
time. Yeah, yeah. We had Paul and all those on, and it was so cool.
Like this,
it was
right?
The humpback whale. That was really that's how I discovered him for radio.
All right.
That was an amazing
show. Well, I'll let you know, Josh. I go to the Costa Dulce every now and then. I hire boats because I need to go off coast like 40 nautical miles to a sea.
Research
there.
I got other friends that do all that. I stay in the Gulf. I just have a Ponga, 9 meters. It's
that's good.
Perfect for inside the Gulf, But the boats with a couple motors that go offshore, the guys that go fishing out there.
Mm-hmm.
There's the FAD, the fish attracting device. It's out like 50 miles.
Yeah, those are. I'm fishing off one of those. Yeah, they're 40 miles out there.
Okay.
But they ruled them out, right? They're gonna remove them.
Oh yeah, well I don't know anything about that. We caught a yellowfin. We caught a tuna 3 miles offshore the other day. So you don't have to go that far. I'm not a great fisherman or anything, but we still catch fish. And what I've really learned about you, Randall, and what you do is you're not against. You're for helping the locals to catch fish, and you don't want them to be like cut off from their food supply. but you're against greed and corporations overfishing everything
and
making
that
it a problem. So mm-hmm. I really respect amazing what you're doing for that.
Killing because endangered species.
You're for the small guy. And you know what I mean? That's what I love about you. So
thank all you. Right, thanks. You know that fishing can work. You know, fishing can be sustainable. But you absolutely know, one of my favorite scientists, his name is Daniel Pauly. He's from Canada, and you know, he's one of the world's most famous fishery biologists. And he says it very clearly: the future of fisheries is in small scale fisheries. The doom of fisheries is industrial fisheries.
Right.
That's what's screwing us up. The industrial fishing.
Whatever greed becomes
the bycatch, all of it.
We have a problem.
Yeah, just all the extraction and the bycatch and the factory bugs. And it's like, hey, this isn't infinite. Stop treating it like it was.
I know.
I see guys with, you know, the hand line, you know, they have a hand line on the beach and they're pulling up a 30-pound Dorado. You know, I see the guy put it over his shoulder. He's running up the sand, you know, and those things still happen around here because it's still so alive here. I mean, I see just millions of sardines and millions of lisas and all these fish. It's like boiling water here. It's so alive still, and it's so great to see it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I like to work with the small-scale fishers here in Costa Rica. I work with them out in Coyote.
Okay.
And I work with several different communities.
They're giving us time's up.
They're sustainable guys.
They're giving us time's up, and thank you so much for everyone that's on today. Next week, Randall.
All right, next week.
Do it again.
And send me Janina's email, and I'll send her some information.
I'll send it to you right now. And I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Randall, so much. It's glad to be back on radio with you. It was so fun before.
Love you guys.
See you later.
Bye, okay.
Glad to meet you, Josh.
Bye, till next week.
Talk to you later, Janina.
Bye. Great to meet you guys. Bye-bye. Ciao, ciao.
Bye.
Love you guys. Pura vida.
You're listening to Jungle Janna Radio with Jungle Janna and Angel Garcia only on LA Talk Radio.